Okay, let's get started. So today we'll be discussing Markov addition processes. I'm more or less going to go through the slides because it's sort of textbook material, and some of you already know it, and you know some probably need, and I'll you know probably need a refresher. But either way, since we've been talking about atomic representations for a variety of beyond classical search, this is obviously one part that we you know should look at again. Then, as I said, we will at a later point we'll also do PAMDPs, partially observable Markov addition processes, which will bring in the the partial observability part into the model. And in a way, I think if you assume observability, then you can say everything else that you have seen till now is sort of subsumed by MDP model. That's one thing that we'll notice. It's actually significantly more general in some cases than is needed really, because for example, there are no goals in MDPs, right? We talk about reward functions, and reward functions can be arbitrary. And so to really, in fact, to get goals of achievement in MDPs is not all that obvious. So before we get started, let's ask the following question. So suppose you have an MDP where you want actually to say that certain states are goals and all other states are non-goals. How do you represent that? So you can give a reward function, plus reward function, then is that enough? Because the problem is that if you just give a positive reward to a state, you can keep collecting that reward by going back to that state many, many, many times. So you need to, if you want to, the normal expectation for goal is that you get the reward only once, right? If you want it that way, then you have to make sure that once you reach that state, you can't get out. Okay, you will get your reward and there are no transitions out of that state. Because if you can have transitions out of that state, then you can get rewards multiply. And here is actually, so we talked about that. So, you know, one of the other interesting questions is from, you know, remember, in terms of the propositional representations, right, if I say G1 and G2 are your goals, then what this is saying is, look at all the states of the world where G1 and G2 is true, make them all sync states. In the MDP parlance, you basically make them sync states. That means, you know, you get to that state, you can't get out. Okay, and then you get immediate reward, which is equal to however good that goal is for you. Okay, now, so this is one interesting point. That's the other thing to think about is, so now suppose I said, really I have G1 etc. up to G100, achieve as many as you can. Looks like a much nicer problem, right? I mean, this is sort of a partial satisfaction problem. You don't need to achieve all goals, just achieve as many as you can. It turns out that clearly you should be able to, so in fact in this case it's not really conjunction, these are all the goals, these are all the options that you can achieve. The more you achieve, the more reward you collect, right? Now, first question is it or is it not subsumed by MDP model? I mean, can you compile that kind of a problem down into an MDP? Okay, it should be possible. The question of course is, it's not, the compilation is slightly tricky. I mean, how would you actually do it? How would you compile that into an MDP?
Make one spare variable for every goal and can't reach the goal state that originally got it, that goes variable is true, otherwise you duplicate the number of actions. Every action that could go to a goal state now can go to this phantom state that you create that has those arbitrary.
Okay, so that's fine. Did anybody else have that idea? So the most obvious idea would be to say that every state which in which any of these goals are true would be a sort of a goal state, and normally you want that means you want the search to stop there, so you have to make them a sync state. If you make them a sync state, then you're dead, because then you can't get any other goals. So say, well, let's not make them a sync state, let's make them non-sync states. Then you have the other problem. You will repeatedly collect reward for the same goal multiple times. So one idea, yes.
Well, I mean, my immediate idea would you have to have you make the state of change exponentially large. So as soon as you hit a goal, you can still hit all the other goals, but then you can never go back to the same goal. But that would make it really large.
No, that's what I'm saying. You have some subspace so you have 24 or 100 spare variables. Originally, all those variables are false. Once one of those variables comes true, it can never be false. And so you can only get that to your half the space you've made. And you accomplish another goal, you're down to a quarter of the space. You accomplish another goal, you're down to an eighth of the space. And you just keep doing that until you've accomplished all 100 of the goals, or until there's a goal you can't get.
I'll say, so basically the idea that he is mentioning seems to increase the number of state variables. So if there were 10 state variables to begin with, there will be more now. Okay, many more, essentially, the way he's going. I would suggest that all you need to do is add one extra state variable called done. Okay, and so the idea is basically that So what that would then do is, if you add one extra state variable, how big does the state space increase? Assuming Boolean state variables. If you just add one extra state variable, how much do you increase the state space size by? You double it. Okay? So in essence, this done thing is saying that I have the base space where I'll be going around through the various states. Okay? And at some point of time, I'll say I'm done. And then I get to collect rewards. And then in the done space are all the sync states. Okay, that's the only reason I'm bringing this up, is that MDPs actually subsume pretty much large number of problems that you know that they should, but actually compiling them down may sometimes be non-trivial. Okay, this is just a partial satisfaction planning is one simple example, but in general. Because you are allowing general reward models where any state can have any reward, right? So you know that you can actually catch more than just the goals of achievement. You can also catch the trajectory goals. So those that say whenever you go through this state, you get a little reward. Okay. Anyway, so I'm going to go through the actual slides and then. But before that, let's just say important reminder, next week you don't need to show up. Okay, you can still show up and talk to each other, that's fine with me, but I won't be here. And then I'll be back on 9:28 when we will sort of continue where we left off. Okay, that's the thing. And then I think I'll owe you one more class which I will make up at some point of time. In terms of the mutual exclusion?
No, the conflict, the mutex.
Yeah, so all I said about that paper is that you could reason about the mutexes, but it didn't wind up being all that useful in, that's what I meant. Okay. But if that is interesting to you, you can read more on that. I mean, that's what we'll wind up doing. Some topics we should definitely understand. Others you can go farther depending on your interest, figure out course. Okay. Basically you have what MDPs capture really is they will allow MDPs, what do they allow? They'll allow, they'll still have instantaneous actions. They will change the action from being deterministic to stochastic. That's it. Okay? So as general as it looks as if this is a pretty general model, it still assumes full observability. Okay, it still assumes full observability. It still assumes sole source of change. Okay, so the only idea, only if there is no dynamism, there's stochasticity. That means when you do an action, the world will go into one of certain configurations. How it goes into is completely stochastic. When you have another agent, then you really need to reason about the intentions of that agent. okay, which is more interesting. So there are generalizations of the MDP models to capture all the other things too. For example, if you are into alphabet soup of MDPs, then MDP can also be called FOMDP, fully observable Markov decision process. When you just say MDP, that's what normally people mean, and that's what we are talking about today. Then, so you can talk about FOMDP, partially observable Markov decision processes. Okay, that will essentially, so this will just bring in stochastic actions. This also brings in stochastic observability. It's more than partial. You basically say, I'm like 0.7 certain that I'm seeing a tiger in that room. Right? That's what it is, you know. Stochastic observability. And then there is, from here, you can go to SMDP. That's semi-Markov decision processes, which essentially allow actions to be non-instantaneous. Non-instantaneous actions. And so, of course, you can go from here and here to POSMDP if you want, right? And then, if you want to start talking about multiple agents, then basically these are, you know, you can go from these to DEC. MDPs and PomDPs, except mostly DEC basically stands for decentralized. Okay, mostly people start, you know, people think about DEC PomDPs. Why? Because if you do have other agents, it's rarely the case that you can read their minds completely. Right. So even if in fact the world is observable, the world, you know, the room is observable, I still don't know what's going on in your head. So as soon as I have other agents, it's sort of partially observable now. Okay, so that's the alphabet soup of MDPs. There are more things can be made for, you know, various versions, and we'll start talking about just MDPs. The good thing about MDPs is that complexity for optimal policy is only polynomial. Only polynomial, except in what? I mean, this is what I mentioned this in a couple of classes back, that MDPs are only polynomial, and in some sense, MDPs should be more general than classical planning, because every classical planning problem can be, you know, compiled down into an MDP. So clearly, this must be polynomial in something else other than state variables. This is the number of states. All MDPs are polynomial in the number of states. And it turns out that when you go to PomDPs, they too can be compiled down. A PomDP is really, so a, remember what we did in the atomic, in the beyond classical search things. Once you had partially observable, I mean, once you had partial observability, that means you don't know which state you are in, then you made it into fully observable by saying, I'm not searching in the states, I'm searching in the belief states. Belief states are fully observable. Do you understand what I'm saying? Belief state, because you know, I mean, if you're not sure, you just add some more states to where you think you are, and that will be fully observable, right? So you can always convert a non, you know, a partially observable search into a fully observable search by doing search not in the space of states, but in the space of belief states, right? So the same thing you will do for PomDPs. PomDPs are PomDPs in the space of belief states. Partially observable Markov decision processes are fully observable Markov decision processes, except in the space of belief states. Okay, now the sad part is that we know that when we're talking about non-determinism, then if you have, you know, n state variables, you have 2 power n states, and you have 2 power n state belief states. Mm-hmm. Okay, so something that's polynomial in states is really exponential in state variables. Okay, and something that's polynomial in belief states is exponential in states, and so doubly exponential in state variables. Right? Except once you start talking about palm DPs, you are actually talking about distribution. It's not just what are all the states, but for every belief state, so suppose you think you are in S1, S2, or S3. Your friend also thinks he's in S1, S2, or S3. Except your belief distribution is this is 0.1, this is 0.3, this is 0.6. And this guy's distribution is 0.2, 0.4, and 0.4. So then there are two different belief states once you take the distributions into account. So each belief state of 2^2 n will become infinite number of distributions, right? So it's so happy that the number of belief states in the palm DPs are infinite, because you no longer just care about the entities in the belief state, but also the distribution. So you can easily write a polynomial time algorithm for palm DPs, because it's still palm DP in the belief state space. Okay, except obviously what you'll wind up doing is it's not as bad. It turns out that what you wound up doing is that something that we avoided all this while, you know, there was one thing we never changed in this class until now, which is we always kept variables to be discrete. State variables were always discrete. States were always discrete. Right? And we jealously guarded that. But when you came to palm DPs, belief states are continuous, because the number of distributions are essentially, you can change this distribution to a different distribution by just adding an infinitesimal quantity to one of these values and subtracting it from another one. So in fact, palm DPs, you will be brought in kicking and screaming into continuous state spaces, which you avoided until now. Okay, that's kind of interesting. You know, I mean, there are continuous state spaces all over the place. You can talk about search in continuous state spaces. You know, in palm DPs, you would end up doing that when we get there. Okay, so that's the alphabet soup of MDPs and how the complexities compare. Okay, so all that change is stochastic, and you still are fully observable in MDPs. Okay. And this you already know, disjunctive or non-deterministic uncertainty essentially says I'm agnostic about what the distribution is, and essentially these are the states that are there. And stochastic probabilistic, you have extra information, you know the distribution also. Okay. So Markov decision processes, you have a set of states, a set of actions, and a transition function. This is the atomic model, and any factored model can be compiled down into this representation, essentially. Okay, so a finite action set and a finite state set and a Markov transition function. It's a transition function is Markov because it basically says if you do an action in this state S, the probability that you will be in S dash. That's the only number that you need to know. If in fact it's non-Markov, then it will have to say if in the last 10 iterations you were in the following 10 states and you then did this action, what would be the new state be? Did you understand what I'm saying? So that's what becomes non-Markov. And it's semi-Markov process, Markov decision processes basically have to care not just about the current slice of time, but that current slice of time might be part of the duration of a continuous action. So in essence, it needs to care about at least when did that action start. And that's why semi-Markov decision processes sort of semi-give up on the Markov assumption. Okay. In general, again, temporal planning is interesting for the same reasons, whether you have stochastic transitions or not. Actions have duration. You know, that makes things interesting in a different dimension. Okay, so you have a transition function, which is just this probability. Probability that if you do action A in state S, the probability that you will be in F dash is a number. Okay, and for it to be well behaved, all you need to know essentially is those numbers for a given action and a state. add up to 1. If you do the action, you know, then from a state S, you can go to, let's say, 15 states, you add up those numbers, it should have to add up to 1. That's what we meant by saying if you have a transition matrix, you add up the columns in each row, they will have to sum up to 1. Right? And then on top of that, so this basically states the actions and the how the actions are non-deterministic, and also how you know that you have a belief as to whether they're likely to go to one state or another state. In non-deterministic actions, you just know that when you toss a coin, it can be heads or tails. You really don't know. If you didn't even know whether the coin I'm holding is a fair coin or not, then you don't even know whether heads are likely to come more, tails are likely to come more, whether they're both equal. You just have no clue. Okay. In this case, essentially, you're giving this information. So in some sense, by giving this information, I'm telling you what kind of a coin I'm holding. Okay. And then this is the stand-in for the goals that we've been talking about before, reward function. Okay. Now the reward function essentially is the immediate reward we get for being in the state S. Again, there are multiple small variations on these models. This is, if you understand this model, it's good enough. There are certain other variations where, for example, they talk about getting a reward in a state based on the action you took to get to that, which is sort of like the reward can be negative. So for example, if you're doing an action in a state, you might incur some cost to do that action. And you can include costs into the MDPs, not just rewards. Negative rewards are costs, for example. Okay. And the cost could depend upon both the state and the action, if you want. And that is a slightly more general model, but it's not different enough to actually bother having to do that separately. Okay. So this is, you know, you just assume that there's a reward for each state, and so in a goal-based domain, RS may be equal to 1 for all goal states and 0 for all others, and that's only part of the story, unless you allow them to take infinite number of, you know, visits to that state and keep collecting rewards. You need to also make sure that that goal state is a sync state. Once you go there, you can't get out. Okay. And then, as I said, can be generalized to include auction cars, can be also generalized to be a stochastic function. That is, in the sense, the rewards themselves can be stochastic. We'll just assume right now that it's this deterministic. Rewards are deterministic. Okay. And, you know, there are ways of generalizing the simple Markov MDP model to also continuous states, that is fully observable continuous state Markov decision processes, which is exactly what discrete state PomDPs really are. Discrete state PomDPs are fully observable continuous state MDPs, because, you know, the states for the PomDPs will become continuous. Okay. But we would not talk about that. The simple model is what we'll look at now. And if you think about what the transition we're talking about, so you are in some state S, the agent is in some state S, it's fully observable, so it can look around and say, I'm in state ST. It knows, agent knows, right? And as soon as it knows, actually, reward is just accrued. Whether you know or not, you get the reward, right? That's a good thing. In some sense, you know, it's like, people can fall backwards into money without knowing that that's what, you know, they're doing. So they still get the reward. Okay. So as soon as you are in the state, you get the reward for that state, which you kind of experience. You know, the agent experiences that reward. Okay. And then from that state, the agent can go to a different state, ST plus 1. Okay. In the next time point. The way the state that it will get into depends not just on the previous state, but also the action it chose to do. The action it chose to do. Okay? And then, and so on. So, and then when you did reach that state, you get the reward for that state, and then you can choose to do some other action, you'll get one more state, you get the reward for that. Since rewards are supposed to be good, presumably, solving a Markov decision process should mean getting a maximum aggregate reward of some kind. So if I'm getting a reward here, a reward here, a reward here, how do I combine the rewards? There are multiple ways of combining them. You can talk about cumulative reward you got, before you died. So you just add up all the, you know, rewards you got. You can talk about average reward you are getting per year or per iteration. You can talk about discounted reward models. That means, you know, the reward that you will get much later will cause, which would be that you expect to get later, are considered to be lower in value than the rewards that you're getting right now. So $10 today may not be less than $100 10 years from now. Okay, so those are different ways of combining rewards into a aggregate, you know, reward metric. And based on that, you get different optimization algorithms. Okay, today we will look at least two of them. One is simple addition of rewards, okay, which actually makes good sense as long as, you know, it turns out that the Markov addition process, as long as you're interested in finite horizon, that means you're only allowed to live certain number of years. Okay, so basically in a finite horizon Markov addition process, it starts from some state and keeps doing this, and after it, if the horizon is 100, then as soon as it reaches 100, it no longer gets to do this. Whatever it got up to that point is the reward it got. Aggregate function of that would be the reward it got. And infinite or indefinite horizon Markov addition process, there is no end to this. It can keep going. Of course, in some states, could be sink states. And if you reach the sink states, you can't do anything more, and so you stop doing anything. Right? In which case, even in an infinite horizon Markov addition process, these are called trajectories. Okay? A trajectory doesn't necessarily have to be infinitely long just because the horizon is infinite. Because you pushed yourself into a dead, you know, a sink state. Okay? And in fact, one thing that we'll talk about, and you know, some of you probably remember, is that even if you have an infinite horizon MDP, a policy for that MDP would be called a proper policy. It will be called a proper policy if you follow that policy, and I'm assuming that you know what policy is, even though I didn't discuss it here because you read it before you come into the class. If it's a proper policy, then the probability that it would end in a finite level, after a finite number of iterations, is 1. Then that's why it's called a proper policy. So everything eventually gets you into one of the states from which you can't come out. That's a proper policy. Okay, so that's one way of reasoning with infinite horizon Markov addition processes, where once everything is going to be finitely large, you can combine rewards by just adding them up if you want. The other possibility is, I don't want to make that restriction. I want to allow for the possibility that a trajectory can be infinitely long. In that case, just to avoid infinities mathematically, you would need to discount the rewards of the future with respect to the past. I mean, you need to do something such that the sum of infinite number of numbers is not infinite. Okay? And what you wind up doing essentially is you would just say, okay, so R0 times beta power 0 plus R1 plus beta power 1 plus R2 times beta power 2. This is bad notation, you know, in the slides also. This is just a superscript. This is the actual power, right? So this is beta square, and then R3 is the reward you get at the third level, and, you know, beta cube, and so on. A beta less than 1 is the discount factor. And if it is less than 1, and if you know that a bounded real-valued reward function, you have a bounded real-valued reward function, that means no state can give you infinitely large reward. Okay, then that means there is an R max. Right? So if that is the case, then I can take this whole thing and say 1 by R max times R max, and then take the R max inside. If I take the R max inside, then this R0 by R max, R1 by R max, R2 by R max, etc., all of them are less than 1, okay, and then beta is a power series which is already less than 1, and so the whole thing is going to converge. And it's going to be bounded by R max. Okay. So that's one way of dealing with infinite horizon macrodation processes in terms of defining what the utility, what the cumulative reward should be. Okay. Now, by the way, so take this picture. I want to play with this picture a little so that you know you would be able to recognize other things, which you know you may or may not have heard of MDPs before. But suppose I have something like this. A trajectory like that. This would have a name. It's not called Markov decision process, it's called something else. Markov chain. If I am doing a plan and you see me doing my plan, which is going from state to state to state, what is a Markov decision process for me is a Markov chain for you. You understand what I'm saying? You're just an observer and you're trying to figure out what the heck is Rao trying to do. So you were here, then he was here, then he was here. So where exactly is he going to get to next? Okay, that is reasoning with a Markov chain. That's reasoning with other people's plans by observing them, which is basically plan recognition problem, which we have to do a lot of times when we are dealing with other people and you're trying to see what the heck is this driver trying to do and then figure out how to get out of the road right away. Right? That plan recognition is a Markov chain. Because what happens essentially is the actions that are being done by the driver in the car are not observable to you. Of course, certain actions are observable, like you know, hand signals, but mostly you don't know what they're doing with the car. What you're seeing is the states into which the car is getting into. So it's a Markov chain. So Markov decision process is a Markov chain on which the agent has control. Is having control good or bad? So having control is good if you want to actually control the thing. If on the other hand you want to have a happy life, then let somebody else control your life. Right? Okay, so MDPs are harder than Markov chains because you have control over them. The control is ephemeral because you know, actions are only probabilistically affecting the future. But then now that you have a control, you want to prove to yourself, am I doing the right thing? Okay, so Markov chains are one side. Now the other thing is this. So I have something like this. What is that? Something. I mean, look at this thing. So these are observations. Think of this as observations, for example. What? Hidden Markov models, HMMs. Again, you know, some of you may know, some of you may not have known it. So HMMs are what you will see if it's a partially observable world and you're trying to figure out what your friend is trying to do. So you are trying to figure out what the driver in front of you is trying to do through thick fog. It's not a Markov chain because you don't quite know the state of the car. But you're once in a while getting honks, once in a while getting red light falling on you, right? So you, from that, you're trying to figure out, oh, the car must be this side. Oh, the car must be this side. Okay, oh, car, I'm probably under the car, whatever, right? So the point is that if you are trying to do plan recognition of your friend in a fully observable world, it's a Markov chain for you. If you're trying to recognize your friend's plan in a partially observable world, it's an HMM for you. And you might be thinking, man, it's so hard to figure out what my friend is doing. Believe it or not, it's harder for your friend. Because if they want to have any guarantee that the actions they are doing are optimal, because they have control as to how to evolve this Markov chain or the HMM. And that's the action input they are deciding. Okay? So it's kind of worth keeping that in mind because MDPs are really just part of this chain, Markov chain and HMMs and so on. And so many of the things that you know about them will translate once you understand that the additional thing that you have is the control. You know, if you don't have any control, you just sit around and watch the world. Okay? Yes?
How can it be easier for you to plan, to do plan recognition than it is to do planning itself? At some point, couldn't you just go, here's what I've done so far, What would I be doing next? And as if you were doing plan recognition on your plan, that's the next step of your plan.
No. All I'm saying is that if I see somebody doing their plan every day, okay, over a period of time, I can compute these probabilities for the observation. Then I have essentially figured out the HMM model. Okay, which is, so whereas, and you know, what a kid needs to do, so this is actually a good question. What a kid needs to do when the kid comes into this world is to figure out the MDP model, in fact the PalmDP model, in fact a DAC-PalmDP model of the world. Okay, what the parents need to do, you know, if they don't feel like teaching them, you know, is only to figure out the Markov chains and the HMMs. When the kid is going through various crazy fits and tantrums, and you just try to figure out what the heck must it be thinking, or he be thinking, or she be thinking. Okay, the kid actually not only needs to, I mean, he or she has to deal with the states and the observations, but they also have to deal with the action inputs, and they don't even know what actions will do what. Right? So they get, you know, if you think in terms of a model learning issue, learning a Markov chain model is easier than learning an hidden Markov model. Learning an MDP is harder than learning a Markov chain. Learning a PalmDP is even harder than learning an HMM. So that's the way to think about it. You know, one is learning, one is reasoning. Okay. Okay. So it's a nice picture to keep in mind, because it's explaining to you what it's doing, but also these actions are what gives you the control, and the control, with the control comes great responsibility, because then you have to prove theorems on it, right? Okay. So the assumptions: first, you assume MDPs are first order Markovians. First order Markovian essentially means that the probability that doing an AT in a state sequence where the ST is the state in which AT was done, and before that you did AT minus 1 in a state ST minus 1, etc., all the way to S0. This probability is the same as this probability. This is a huge independence assumption. You know, from a Bayes net terminology, from probabilities terminology, what we are saying is, you know, PA given B and C is the same as PA given B. That's an independence assumption. It's a conditional independence assumption. Okay, and Markov assumptions are always huge conditional independence assumptions, saying all that matters about your future is your current state, not how you got there. Now, this is an assumption about the model. You can argue with me and say, no, that's not true in the real world. Okay? And then I'll say, well, you can model the real world, you can compile it down to an MDP model, where everything that matters about your past is brought into the state. And then again, you are past insensitive. Okay? Most MDPs, you know, if you want to have the word MDP, you know, Markov in your name, you have to be first order. I mean, you have to essentially give up on the past. Okay? Semi-MDPs look at basically past up to the duration of the actions to some extent. Okay? Now, the reward process is an interesting one. This is the transition process. This, on the other hand, is the reward process. They are independent entities. Reward process can also be first order or non-first order Markov rotation process. Okay, if your reward in this state depends on, if your reward in this state depends only on the state, but not how you got there, then it's first order Markov reward process. If it depends on what other states you have been through, then it's not first order reward process. What I want to say is, you can independently relax this and this. In most cases, people would relax, in some cases people will relax this before relaxing that. So you could have a first order Markov decision process where the reward model is non-Markovian. So the transitions themselves are completely dependent on the state you are currently in. But the reward that somebody experiences depends on what states they have already visited. This is not a bad distinction. So, for example, some cases, it would be a purely, you know, MDP process, except, you know, to be able to get through to, let's say, you know, from here to, what is this place, Saguaro Lake, which is a beautiful area nearby, right? So I can just drive down to, you know, Saguaro Lake, and assuming that, you know, I have good eyes, etc. Basically, it's a first-order Markovian process. You know, when I make a decision that I'll turn left, I go left, and then I turn right, I go right, and so on. So I can get to Saguaro Lake using a first-order Markovian process. The reward of getting there, however, is complex. I can go all the way there, and then they'll say, sorry, you can't park unless you have the Tonto pass. How many of you have been to anything other than classes, including things like Saguaro Lake? So if you go to Saguaro Lake, which is a very beautiful area, I mean, you know, Phoenix is one of these great places where you are is particularly depressing. You have to come to classes, but you take off for an hour or two, they're beautiful places. And, you know, Saguaro Lake is like 40 miles, that's it, you know. It's a beautiful place, and if you ever go there, and I'm giving you useful advice now, you will find that to actually park your car, you need something called the Tonto Pass. Now, Tonto Pass won't be sold there. It will be sold in the REI here, or it will be sold in the Sports Authority here. So whether or not you will get reward there depends on whether you went to these states. So are you going to tell me that the transition function in this world is non-Markovian? No. But the reward is definitely non-Markovian. Do you understand what I'm saying? So that's why you separate these, and there are many fully observable first-order Markovian process papers which talk about, you know, non-Markovian reward. And, you know, trying to put everything into the state is one way of making things Markovian, but here there may be other approaches because the transition is still Markovian anyway. Okay? Mm-hmm. No, but that's the interesting point. The question is, that basically makes it a reward, conditional reward function. And if it's a conditional reward, then it's non-Markovian. Right? If it's a conditional reward and says, those people who went to REI and have Tonto Pass with them will enjoy this place. The rest of them will feel like fools and come back. Or break the law and just park the car anyway. And not that I did it, but the point is that the moment you make reward conditional, you're making it non-Markovian. I mean, you can't say that, you know, it's a very interesting point. I mean, these are things to think about in terms of models. I mean, these look very simple things, but they have direct consequences in terms of what kinds of worlds you can model and what assumptions are inbuilt in them. Yes, sir?
Is the cumulative reward an example of the relaxed Markovian reward?
Which one?
No,
cumulative reward is the way you are defining the value of a behavior. So a behavior is a sequence of states that you went through. Okay, given a sequence of states you went through, you can define so if I tell you the rewards for each state, then you need to still tell me what is the overall reward of this. So this is a problem that you have to deal with whether you have conditional rewards or not.
So is that because you want to determine if you're good? I mean, is that like a box check or something like that?
In terms of the behavior?
Yeah.
Because we haven't actually talked about the planning problem here yet. We're just talking about the model. The planning problem is what action input is the agent going to provide to that? And figuring out what action to do in what state is the planning problem. And you want to the extent reward is the currency, and there is an aggregate reward function that you agreed upon, then you need to, if you want to prove something about your way of doing actions in states, you want to say that my way of doing actions in states is better than yours. How do I compare? We'll use the same aggregate reward accumulate. I mean, so if I know the rewards of individual states that I got, then we'll combine them in the same way, we'll, you know, on a pre-agreed way, and then I'll say that my number is bigger than the number you got. And that's how you get to define, you know, optimal policies. Okay? Okay, so this is an interesting distinction. I mean, again, it just went through, but I think you should understand this. And then stationary dynamics and stationary reward. So all that means is that the reward does not, the dynamics don't depend upon the time of the day. So whether you did this action in the beginning of your behavior or whether you did it after first 15 actions were done, so suppose you consider doing action A in state 15. In one behavior, you did action A in state 15 in the very beginning. In another behavior, you did it after you did some other 15 actions, then you just happened to reach state 15 and you did action A. The transition that will happen after action A, that's independent of whether you did it before or after. Again, that's an assumption. It might make sense, it might not make sense. Okay? If it makes sense, then basically what you're saying is the transition function is time invariant. Okay? And that R, it is stationary. And the same thing for rewards. Rewards also can be stationary, essentially. That means whether you got into that state in the very beginning of your behavior or much later in the behavior, you get the same reward. Okay, that's the stationarity. And then finally, full observability. You should know at any point of time what state you are in. Okay, and that's how basically, because you'll know at any point of time what state you are in, you can just have a big table which tells you if you are in this state, do this action. If you're in this state, do this action. Basically, all of those have to be built in terms of essentially the rewards that you provide to states. Okay, so what's interesting is think of MDPs as our Intel processor. Okay, any problem you want needs to be compiled down. When it is compiled down into assembly language, programs don't look like the ones that you wrote at all. All you basically know is what programs can be compiled down. Okay, and once they are compiled down, all the MDP hardware will know is reward per state. But in the higher level language, you might have said very complex things. Okay, then you need to find a reasonable MDP compilation for that. So right now we are talking about how the Intel PC works. Okay, and if you want to write a complex program, it's up to you to have a compiler which will take that complex program into Intel PC program. And Intel PC program doesn't care who wrote the original program. It just does its machine instructions. And you need to understand how that works, and that's what we're doing here. Right? Okay, so policies. So basically the solutions for Markov decision processes are what do you do in each state that you find yourself in. Okay, and then now the interesting thing, of course, is that basically it's a function which takes the state, okay, and a policy normally can be a function which takes the state and the current time period. This is the timeless Markov decision processes, instantaneous actions. So when I say T, time, then that means zeroth time is when you start the behavior. Then after one action, you become one time, another action, second time, time two, time three, etc. Okay? Then a policy basically, so there's a clock that's going on, which is only incremented based on the actions you did. Zero means zero actions have been done till now. Five means five actions have been done till now. Right? And then, so all you are doing essentially is you have a function which takes the current state and the wall clock time and says, do this action. That's the most general policy. Okay, that basically says, based on the time and the state you are in, pick a particular action. And it's just a function. Now notice that this function pi, basically pi is what people write for policies, that's like a convention. The function can be, I didn't say whether the function has to be deterministic or stochastic. Okay, and that's an interesting question. So for example, I could say that the function that I have in mind could be that if you are in this state 500 and the wall clock says 15th iteration, then take a round and shiny coin which comes heads 70% of the time and tails 30% of the time and toss it. And if it comes heads, do the first action, tails do the second action. That will be a function still. It will tell you one action to do. But how it figures out that action internally is by stochastic means. And those are essentially called mixed policies. In game theoretic terms, they are called mixed strategies. Okay, so MDPs are playing game against nature. If you are into games, MDPs are playing a game against nature. Okay, normally you know from games. So in game terminology, you talk about strategies. A policy is a strategy for the game. Have you ever tried to play rock, paper, and scissors with a deterministic strategy? And I think some of you, I already told you about this. There was this great Simpsons episode where Bart Simpson and Lisa Simpson try to settle something by, they're trying to settle, you know, whose way should be given, you know, taken. And then Bart suggests that, you know, let's just play rock, paper, and scissors. And then there are these two big, you know, bubbles in both their heads. And Bart is very happy thinking, oh, we get to play rock, paper, and scissors. And then Lisa was saying, oh, we get to play rock, paper, and scissors. We know that Bart always picks rocks. Okay, so that's his deterministic strategy. And if you know what your strategy is, you're dead, basically, in that case. So there cannot be a deterministic strategy for certain games. Do you understand what I'm saying? So given that normally games don't have to have pure strategy, sometimes the optimal strategy for a game has to be mixed. You cannot ever win rock, paper, scissors by saying, this is the strategy I'm going to follow. You can say it, but that has to be a stochastic strategy. Say, here is my round and shiny coin that I'm going to, you know, toss before I make the decision. Okay, that randomness has to be there, otherwise you can never win. Rather, you can never not lose, more like it, okay? So the interesting thing that you have to ask yourself is, if in fact some games can have mixed strategies as their best strategies, and if MDPs are playing a game against nature, optimal policy for an MDP could be a mixed policy. Do you understand what I'm saying? And so what's interesting, the huge relief that should wash over you is that as long as you're playing against nature, who is indifferent to you, that's the good thing about nature, right? Your opponents, on the other hand, are not indifferent to you. They know exactly what you're thinking, and they try to model you. Okay, if you are playing against the nature, then the optimal, if there is an optimal policy, then there will also be an optimal pure policy, non-mixed policy. So again, you know, some slides later you would have realized that we will just look for the deterministic policies and they are guaranteed to exist. That looks like a small point, but it's actually a huge point, because in games you don't expect there to be pure strategies for all games. So why should that be the case for general MDPs? It's because nature is indifferent. And so basically, if there is an optimal policy which is mixed, there's also an optimal policy that's pure. Okay? So the only thing that we're talking about here is non-stationarity. The policy was dependent upon the wall clock time. Right? And so somehow it basically says that it decides the action to do based on how many stages. In fact, the way to actually think about it, even though I said this wall clock time in terms of the number of actions that are completed, it's actually better to think in terms of number of actions still to go. Do you understand what I'm saying? So, you know, you can basically, it's a countdown clock instead of a count up clock. Okay, and if you want to have a countdown clock, you can already start seeing that this only makes sense to certain kind of MDPs, right? You can't have a countdown clock for infinite horizon Markovnation processes, because it'll always be infinite. So you have to assume that if you're counting down, it's a finite horizon. And really, if the action you do depends on how many more ticks are left, then it will be the same if you have infinite horizon, because there will always be infinite number of ticks left. Whereas in a finite horizon, it changes. Okay. So the interesting thing is that this is a non-stationary policy. A stationary policy just ignores the clock and says, if this is a state, do this action. Okay. For infinite horizon mass causation processes, the optimal policies will be stationary. Otherwise, it makes no sense because the T will always be infinite. It's counting down. Right? And for finite horizon mass causation processes, it depends on how much longer you have to live. So in particular, if T equal to 0, that means what? You're dead. There's nothing to do. T equal to 1, you have one action left to do. So I'm just telling you, right now, that next microsecond you're going to die, decide what's your best action. And somehow, while I would hope that you'll quickly remove from your satchel the MDP paper and start reading it, I feel that's not the action you're going to do. You'll do something else. Okay? The point, of course, is the optimal action you do depends upon how long you think you will live. This is why there are portfolio strategies which will say, if you're close to retirement, put all your money under a pillow. And if you're not close to retirement, put all your money in Wall Street, which will then lose it. And then you have no pillow to buy later on. Okay? But the point is, the reason the portfolio strategies change is because we only live for a finite amount of time. Right? Okay? And actually, in fact, having said that, so for finite horizon mass causation processes, you will always get these policies which are indexed by the number of ticks to go. And what's interesting is that looks like a more complex policy than this, which does the same thing for every state. So for a finite horizon mass causation process, which has S number of states, and the horizon is T, okay, and the number of actions per state is A, just the number of things you have to remember, the size of the policy is F times A times T. That's the size of the policy. Right? Whereas if it is infinite horizon, you would think it should become infinitely large. But it really is only S times A. Because it makes no sense to have, you know, any dependence on the time, especially if you're thinking in terms of, you know, countdown. And it turns out that even though originally I said think of count of clock, forget about that. You know, you should always think in terms of countdown clock. You normally only decide how to do something, even in your life, based on how long you think you will survive. Not based on how long I have lived. I mean, that's what society wants you to do. You're old enough, you should wear purple clothes, right? But you don't decide it that way. You decide it based on, look, I only have 3 days left. You know, let me not wear any clothes or something, right? So you decide your reward based on the future, how much more you think you have to live, not based on how long you thought you lived, okay? So it's always good to think in terms of countdown clock. And then one of the interesting things is it also has this advantage when we'll see that if you're dead already and you are in a particular state, then the reward you get is whatever you just got there. There's no more future for you. So at least the value functions are easier to define. You know, when there's zero time left, then whatever you just got is what you got. Okay? Anyway, then, you know, this would be a stationary policy, that's non-stationary policy, and then we will be looking at policies which are full observability. They'll look at the state, and they are history independent. They don't care about the states you have gone through, and they're deterministic action choice. This is the point I was making. Why are you looking for deterministic action choice? Why must this function be deterministic? It doesn't have to be. If you know more, you'd start wondering, why did this happen? Now, in games, there can be mixed strategies, but in games, you need mixed strategies exactly because the other player models you. If Lisa didn't know who she was playing with, then it doesn't matter that Bart has a deterministic strategy. If it's the first time she played with him, it's because she has played with him long enough and knows that he always picks rocks, you know, which is once it's known, you know, you're dead. Okay, so now we're going to talk about values of the policy. So if I have a policy which is sort of defined this way, how do you decide how good is a policy? The basic idea is you define a policy based on the behavior sequences that it leads you through. And since it's a stochastic world, Every time you run the policy, it will take you to a different set of behavior sequences. So you need to, and each time you go through a sequence, you get different set of rewards. And suppose there is a way you decided to combine them. If I said nothing else, assume you added them. Then every behavior sequence will give you a different cumulative reward. And how do you say, how good is this policy? You consider the expectation. Do you understand what I'm saying? And this is a very reasonable thing to do. You cannot say, for example, that somebody's policy is a dumb policy because they got killed. You have to say that people who follow that policy, so for example, drinking and driving is no fun. I mean, it's not good, let's say, okay? But then, you know, you drank and were driving and your friend, you know, was sober and was driving next to you and you were about to get into an accident. The friend was saying, no, don't get into the accident, and then the friend hit the tree instead of you. So the question is, whose policy is right? Your friend's policy of not drinking or your policy of drinking and driving? You know, if you base on just one particular example, it looks like your friend was silly. He should have drunk too. Then he would not have wasted his time trying to tell you to not hit somebody. Okay. But on the other hand, if you do this game long enough, then you know that the people who drink and drive are going to get into more accidents than the people who don't drink and drive. That's why you assume that this one is a better policy. So expected value of the policy is higher. So policy P1 is better than policy P1 is better than P2 if the expected value of the behavior sequences, expected cumulative reward over the behavior sequences that are shown by this policy are better than the one shown by this other policy. And you can nicely write this formally with all the notation we currently have. Okay? So now how do you measure this accumulated reward? So you are talking about accumulated reward, right? Policies will be better based on the sequences of states that they go through and the accumulation of reward over them. And one way of thinking about, you know, rather than think in terms of sequences of states, you can say that every state in the MDP has a value attached to it. Okay? Now, that value is a real valued function. It just attaches a real number to each state. Now, this looks like a reward, except it's not reward. Reward is the immediate gratification. If you are dead right now, reward is your value. If that's the sink state, immediate reward is the only value that state has. The reward of the state, the value of a state really depends on what you get to do starting from that state. Right? I mean, they keep saying that. I mean, you can go to college and then start and still sell, you know, fries in McDonald's, you know, or do something else that doesn't get you that much money. It's up to you as to how you use your education, how you use the state that you got into. Okay? So a value of a state depends on what you would do starting from that state. Okay? I got a college education. Einstein got a college education. I would say that the value of my college education is not that high compared to the one that he got. And it's not because of the colleges necessarily. In fact, I think he went to a worse college than mine. But it's because of what he did after that. He chose to do actions that I didn't necessarily do. Okay, this is a tricky point. The value of a state depends on what you get to do from there. Given the same exact college education to two people, one of them will do something completely different than others. And in the end, that's why you still want to say who you know, basically you evaluate people after they die. I mean, people knew exactly what Ted Kennedy was about, right? And New York Times always has, for all the famous people, they always have an obituary ready. Because you never know when they're going to die. Okay? But they won't show it to you. And the day they, and so you would always wonder, how is it that they have, you know, when Ted Kennedy died, New York Times had 3 full pages. You know, I mean, how did these guys start writing down so fast? It's because they have been writing it. And if just before he died he did something hugely goofy, they would have changed the obituary right then. Do you understand what I'm saying? So the value depends on from the state that you are in, you know, what are the actions you did and how much of the reward you're able to get. Okay? And so what you would write, this value function can be defined with respect to normally a policy. Suppose you are using a policy pi, Then starting from this state S, if you start this policy, look at this policy and says what you're supposed to do in this state, and do that, then you'll be in a new state. The policy tells you what to do in that state, do that, you'll be in a new state. And if it's a finite horizon, do it as much as the horizon says. If it's infinite horizon, do until you get to a sync state, or you combine it in a discounted way. Then you have one behavior, and you got the accumulated reward on that, from that state. Now again, start from the state, using the same exact policy, do this once more. Do this about 1,000 times, average it out. That's the value you are likely to get by starting from this state and following this policy. This is why the guy who was not drunk, you know, on one example sequence, he died prematurely. And the guy who was not, who was drinking, didn't die. The guy who, you know, drank, you know, I mean, you see what I'm saying, right? But if you do this multiple times, if you let the world go through multiple times starting from the same state, then you are likely to get the right values. Okay? Yes, sir. It's not random walk. Random walk means you're randomly deciding, going. So,
on the,
this is with respect to the policy.
Yeah. Nothing random walk on your, what you can say, set up states or actions, whatever you want to
find. No. It's a very good question, and you better understand the difference between starting from a state and doing random walk.
So starting from the state to a random walk, and you keep doing it, and over a time you collect the distribution or something.
No. That basically means you don't need to do anything in the world. You have no control over the world. So you just do random actions, you don't need to think, and if it's a really good state, even dumb people who didn't think should be able to get to the top of Everest. They don't. They all fall apart in that, you know, Hillary step. You know, I actually fall apart here itself, I don't even get anywhere near that. Okay? But the point is, there is an optimal sequence of actions that you can do, and even then you fall apart sometimes. But if you do random walk, your probability of getting to the top is like much lower. It's not at all random walk, it is following the policy. When you follow the policy, what might happen is still random, but it is with respect to a given distribution. It's a very important distinction. Okay, so starting from a state, there are three things you can do. Get to the state, do random walk. Okay? Get to the state, follow some policy. Get to a state, follow optimal policy. These will take increasing amounts of thinking. If I somehow put you in the state, you know, your parents have enough wealth and they put you in a state of being in the college, right? Then from there you can start doing random walk. Or from there you can start reading up Barron's guide to what to do after college and follow their policy. Or from there you can actually use your brain, think about what should be the optimal policy given your reward system, and find the optimal policy. And those are three different things. I'm not going to be able to convince you that this is better necessarily, because, you know, that's, you know, in fact, you could have huge negative utility associated with thinking. In which case thinking itself hurts your head. I mean, by the way, you ask the question, I'm not at all saying you, I mean, when I say you, okay, but that's an important point to keep in mind. Now, so we talked about the value with respect to a policy pi. Optimal value of a state then can now be defined as value with respect to the best policy. If you consider all policies and do what I just said for each policy and pick the policy that seems to give the best value for the state, that is really the value of the state. So the point of that is that you cannot badmouth a state just because you don't know how to exploit it.
You can,
but not objectively in any way, right? Like, I mean, I think last time when I was teaching this in 471, I pointed out this, that I went to this place called Tiger Hill, in, you know, which is a little hillock, in front of Kanchenjunga, which is this great massif of Himalaya, right? And then at some point of time, you know, most of the people were looking for the sunrise. You know, people somehow, if you give them huge amount of gold and the sunrise or sunset, they'll just look at the sunrise or sunset. It doesn't matter what's on this side. So everybody was looking at the sunrise, and at some point of time, a few minority people started saying, ooh, and then the rest of them turned. Sun is rising at the same way. If you turn back, you realize that sun is showing on the golden peaks of Kanchenjunga, which is what's really the value of that place. So I could have gone to Tiger Hill and come back and say, what's the big deal? You know, it's just sunrise, right? And I can't put it down because I didn't do the optimal action, which could be done there. The value of a state depends on the optimal actions that can be done starting from there, not just by you, by anybody. And if you think enough, and if you have those actions in your case, then you should be able to do them. Okay? So the optimal value is overall the policies. Now, is this a dumb definition? I'm saying consider each policy and simulate it from the state. Is it even feasible? It's actually feasible. Because it turns out there are only finite number of policies. There are only finite number of policies. What? Because if you have A actions that you can do, maximum, A max number of actions you can do, and then there are F max number of states, then each state you can do A max different actions. So all you have is A max power F max. It's a number. It's a finite number. So the only finite number of policies.
It's a big number. That's not always true.
What do you mean it's not always true?
In the real world, you can't actually, like, for example, let's take the financial market. You couldn't have possibly thought of all the things before because something new happened. And then
No. I'm actually talking, so obviously I'm talking about this model, and even within this model, you can make sense. So for example, you can't say that when I went to Tiger Hill, I didn't know that it's in my ability to turn this way as against this way. I knew damn well that I could turn both ways. You could say in financial markets, some of us didn't know how to do complex hedging. Some of you don't have money, so you don't need to do it. But others didn't know what complex hedging they could do. So they don't know certain actions. That's the point you're making. But even if I had the actions, I may choose not to do it because I didn't think. Right? On the Tiger Hill, anybody can turn this side as against that side. And the people who didn't turn this side will come down and say, it's no good. And tourist brochures cannot depend on those bozos. They have to depend on the people who actually looked, they did the optimal thing. Okay? Okay, so you only have the finite number of policies. Okay? And so you can actually do this. There is a brute force approach for computing policies. The nice thing for the rest of the slides, which obviously you have read, and I probably won't get to go through it today, because my horizon is ending, is that there is a structure to the value function. There's a structure to the value function such that if you are talking about a finite horizon policy, instead of doing the policy first, you compute the value function, and then once you know the value function, you can compute the policy. By just picking, if you get the optimal value function, doing greedy action selection. That means selecting the action that will give you the maximum expected value in terms of the neighboring state's values would be the optimal policy. That's what you read.
That's the brute.
What?
That's the brute, right?
No, that's not the brute. That's the definition. That's basically the definition of going from value to policy function.
Okay.
Right? So the interesting thing is for a finite horizon Markov-Dyson process, you don't have a single value function. A value function depends on the horizon, the time clock left.
Sure.
Right? So if you have zero steps left, what is the value function?
Evaluate state.
It's exactly the reward of the state. If you have one step left, what is the optimal value function? In the one step, you get to do actions that will take you to states which have only zero steps left, for which you know the value. So you can compute the best actions at the one step based on the known values at the zeroth step. Okay? No, this is a finite horizon. We're talking about finite horizon. Okay? So basically, if I know the value at time t, then I can compute that value at time t plus 1 by essentially considering each action that I can do in this state, seeing which states it will take me to with what probabilities, multiply the probability times the reward, you get the expected value, and then see which is the best expected value. And this, what you're doing here, going from this value function to this value function, that's called the Bellman backup.
Does it depend on where you think you are? Like what actually
you're,
each state depends on the probability that you're at that state? So
no, but you're considering in for each state you have the actions that you can do, and your model exactly tells you what states you can get to with what probabilities. And if you did get to them, you have a deterministic reward there. And you multiply the probability times the deterministic, I mean not reward, in fact, in this case you have the values already. So multiply the probabilities times the values of the states you reached, you know the expected value of doing this action. This guy will get 0.7 probability to here, 0.3 probability to here, so it gets 0.7 of this guy's value times plus 0.3 of this guy's value. That's the expected value. And you do this for the same thing, and then whichever number is bigger, that's the optimal action. You're doing max over all the actions you can do, and you're backing up. That's Bellman backup. And what you are doing here is you are computing the t plus 1, that is t plus 1 time steps to go value function in terms of t steps to go value function. And there is an obvious end to this because 0 steps to go value is the same as reward. Okay? So, give me a second. So this is basically what they showed, you know, so you have in the V0, the value function is the same as reward. At V1, you can compute the V1 in terms of the values at the zeroth step, zeroth horizon. And then once you have that, you can do the V2, then so that you can do V3. That's how you compute the finite horizon value function. Okay? And then the finite horizon policy is, if you know the value, you know what the policy is. Because for each action that you have, you can compute the maximum expected, you know, if you know the number of steps you have left to go. So for example, you know that somebody told you you have 2 more iterations to go, so you should be looking at this value function, and you consider, you know, given the state you are in, what's the best, and what all the actions you can do, which of them will give the maximum value, which would be computed in terms of V1. Okay? And so this is the finite horizon policy construction, value and policy construction. And in the case of infinite horizon, it actually becomes even simpler because you have to assume that the value can't change because the number of steps to go is infinite always. So you will wind up getting a set of nonlinear equations which are, you know, V is defined in terms of V of the neighbors, but using a max operation. Okay? In the finite horizon case, you just know exactly how many iterations you have to do. In infinite horizon case, you do this Bellman backup enough number of times such that the value stops changing. Okay? I will have to stop here. I realize that, you know, there would be questions further. When I come back, I'll do some more of the discussion if you actually specify the questions. And then we'll go into the propositional MVP.